Hey, g'day there, fellow humans. Mark Lebusque here for the Simply Practically Human podcast. I am thrilled today to be joined by a past guest and someone whose podcast from about 3 or 4 years ago, we put up again about 3 weeks back, Mark C. Crowley, author of Lead from the Heart, podcast host of Lead from the Heart. Check that out as well. He's in the top 1.5% globally on leadership podcasts. Listen to him over 170 countries. Just a good human being. We don't just share the same Christian name. We share a lot of ideas around why bringing more humanity, or as he said today, being more humane in the workplace is now not just a kumbaya thing or some sort of nut job cult. It's actually got a lot of research behind it. And Mark will share some of that today, as well as what he's been up to in the last 3 or 4 years. And just two Marks having a good chat. Have a listen. See what you think, take some notes, and we'll catch you at the end.
Life can get pretty complicated. In the Simply Practically Human podcast, Mark Lebusque talks to incredible humans to see the way forward more clearly through the complexity in the world and in our heads. Let's get ready to thrive.
Hey, I am delighted to be joined by one of my favourite human beings. He's got an amazing Christian name as well, Mark C. Crowley from over in the US. Mark, thanks for joining me.
I'm so thrilled to be back with you.
I've wanted to do this for a while, but not too long back, I reshared the podcast we did quite some time ago and got a great response to it again. And I just thought, geez, we need to catch up again because there's been a bit going on in the world since we last spoke in the space of heart-based and human leadership, hasn't there?
No question, right? I mean, we had this once in a billion year event that kind of altered life permanently as we know it. I think a lot of people believe that everything should go back to exactly the way it was, and it was just a storm, and the rain stopped, the sun's back out, but that's not the case at all, right?
Exactly. Before we get into talking about COVID and some other bits and pieces and what you, I guess some of what you've been doing, for over the last 4 years, what has been going on for Mark Crowley?
Well, you know, it really goes back to 2011 when I realized in the process of writing my book the first time, you know, the truth is that when I wrote it, I my intention was really just to say, I learned some things about leadership that I know are different, that I know are uncommon. And if people would ascribe to that, then I believed it would make them infinitely more successful as a leader and a manager. What I didn't realize in the process was a friend of mine who said, you're going to have to explain why this works. People just aren't going to trust you, particularly if you're recommending things that people aren't used to doing from a management standpoint. And I had given zero thought to that. And in the process, the conclusion that I came to was that not only was I leading people from the heart, literally, but that there is science that proved it. So in the process of writing the first book, I never imagined that I would land on a confirmation that the way that I'd always been leading my entire career successfully and also was prescribing was aligned to human nature in ways that we've never thought to manage people before, all confirmed by science that shows that the heart and the mind are actually working together to inform us. So at that point, I realized, like, I'm not going back to work. I actually have something meaningful to say here, something really, really meaningful to say. And so, of course, I called the book Lead from the Heart based on the science, based on the breakthrough idea. What I didn't anticipate was how much resistance I would get to this idea, specifically because I used the word heart. You know, if I called it killer engagement, I would have done great. You put the word heart in there and people immediately dismiss you and think you're a Hare Krishna or a religious nut or a spiritualist or somebody who doesn't get business. Whatever the fantasy is, I've heard it all. And so answer your question indirectly, you know, I've had to be the Pied Piper for this. I've had to basically realize this isn't going to happen overnight. This isn't going to be a victory where you go to bed and everybody's out front with a parade. That you have to just keep speaking, writing, doing whatever you can do to drip, 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 so that people will inevitably go, you know what? The guy's right. Like, he's not insane after all. So that's what I've been doing since 2011 and certainly over the last 4 years.
Fantastic. So let's just pick up on the resistance here, because I've got a similar story. I know we've talked about this before, but it's just like people used to say to me, we love your results, but we don't like the way you get your results. You're not stressed enough. You seem too happy. Your people are happy. You have a lot of coffees with people. Like, that's not the way we do things around here. So why are those resistors, why are they resisting you and I, do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting because it's a funny story. So I, at my job before I started to write my book, I was leading a couple thousand investment advisors, stockbrokers from all over the United States, 4,000 some odd branches. I had people selling securities, investments, bonds, annuities, you name it. And I had been named leader of the year because in my first year of running that business, we had record revenue, record profit. So the new organization bought the company. I was completely repelled by how they managed. I knew I wasn't going to be a cultural fit. Worked out a deal and I left and I went to write the book. And the process of thinking about the book, organizing the book, writing the book, getting it published, doing all the research took about 2 years. So in that time, no one heard from me. I basically became a hermit and devoted myself to that work. So now the book comes out called Lead from the Heart. And the people that I used to work with were the first ones to go, oh man, what happened to him? Like, did he have like a nervous breakdown or something? Or like, did he find Jesus? Like, this is what people were saying to me. And I'm like, well, I thought that people would go, wow, congratulations on writing a book. But the first reaction that a lot of these people had was, what went wrong? And so for me, at least, no one ever judged how I led. No one ever looked under the hood and said, we don't really like the way you operate. What they loved were the results.
Yep.
No one ever dug deep enough to realize that I had been leading exactly as I've been prescribing the entire time, except the people who worked for me who said, I'm the beneficiary of this. I grew so much. And so I'm sad to hear that people that you work with or superiors thought that your approach was not the family way kind of a thing. Because it meant that they really were jerks if they thought that what you were doing while getting good results was somehow bad.
Yeah.
I never got that. I just got, I don't know what he does, but the guy's really good. And then when the book came out, they thought there was something seriously wrong with me.
When I got told that, I just doubled down. I'm like, I'm going harder at this human stuff. And then just, you know, what you shared there around what happened to you. Where have you been? Where'd you end up? What cave were you put into? What cult had you joined? Right. And in some respects, this human stuff, I don't know the cult's the right word, but trying to create some sort of movement here is a sense I get with how much energy and passion that you put into this. Is this just one human at a time will end up with a whole lot of human beings understanding that leading from below the neck. Also, I'm going to say combining it with what's up here as well.
Correct.
Is a great way to be. So I think this isn't about two Hare Krishnas, as we might call ourselves now, just saying it's all from below the neck. It's got to be from above the neck as well, doesn't it?
They work together. This is what people don't understand. So I call the book Lead from the Heart because when we think about leadership, there's no heart in it. There just isn't any heart in it. So I'm saying bringing back in balance is really where I'm going. They have to work together. So I'm not saying marginalize the brain. It's had its shot. Bring the heart in. We overdo one or the other, we're going to get into trouble. If we overdo the mind, we make decisions that harm people at the interest of making money. And we do it every day. If we do too much heart, we overcare for people, and then the job of leadership is to drive performance and results, and so we can't ever lose sight of that. So if all you do is care about people and you let people off the hook and you don't hold anybody accountable, you're not going to be in your job very long. My idea is that the more you care about people, and I know you believe this, the more you care about people, ironically, the more demanding you can be. So the more people feel supported, safe, valued, appreciated, encouraged, recognized, under development, all those kinds of things, you're making an emotional investment in people, and feelings and emotions drive human behavior, not here. And so when people are marinating in positive emotions, they're willing to scale mountains for you.
Yep. So the good old chestnut, the discretionary effort, I'm very clear when I was doing this work with my team, not nowhere near as big a team as yours, but it was like one of the outcomes I wanted was I wanted to tap into their discretionary effort, that ability to get them to do that extra 1 or 2%. I don't mean by extra 1 or 2% hours and things, but just investing that little bit more time in building relationships or understanding themselves or whatever it might have been. And I think that's where the magic comes, is when you combine both of these. I love your point about you can't have one or the other. When you combine both, the magic happens. I reckon what I got a sense of was that the system, and I know I've read some of your stuff recently too, is like, you know, with working from home and whatnot, I think the system has been sitting in the shadows waiting for its chance to turn back up. After what's happened in COVID, it's like, I'm not going to jump back in straight away, the system has told us, because I'll get rejected, but I'm going to wait some years and then I'm going to start to come back. And it's coming back now, isn't it? The old way of working seems to be getting pushed down people's throats. What are you seeing?
I do believe that there's enough pressure on many companies that hybrid is going to survive this.
Yep.
But at the same time, I just finished an article yesterday for Fast Company, and the premise is that there's a very large American insurance company, Farmers Insurance, and their CEO told their employees during COVID, this is working so well, you never have to come back. So people sold their homes and moved away and, you know, made all kinds of major life decisions. And then that guy, I don't know what happened to him, either retired or he left the company or what, but the new CEO came in and goes, uh-uh. And so he basically reversed the decision and told these people that by September, not only do they have to be back in the office, but they need to be there 3 days a week. So that was like a massive betrayal of trust, because people thought that the CEO like represented the company. Like, God made the decision and there's no reversing it, and I'm going to go make my choices as a result. So then all of a sudden you see companies like Salesforce saying, we want you in the office 4 days a week. So what's happening is that CEOs are saying, we really don't like working from home. We think it undermines collaboration. We think that relationships go south because people don't have enough connection with one another. They also fear that people, when they're working from home, are less loyal, which is a weird conclusion, but they think that they're more likely to leave. And so it's a lot of fear stuff that's sort of circulating in CEOs. But if you ask employees, they're like, you know, none of this really adds up. Your ideas of why we need to come back are really wrong. However, I will say that there's been this Harvard study since 1938. They began studying a group of people. They were white males, you know, well-heeled people at Harvard in 1938. And then they decided that that wasn't going to be a representative sampling of the world. And so they added in low-income people from the Boston area. And they merged these two studies, and since we're talking about 84 years of study, and there's a man named Robert Waldinger, he's in charge of the study, he's a medical doctor, he's a professor at the Harvard Medical School, and he just wrote a book called Good Life, and his premise is, and by the way, this has been concluded, they've had five different directors for this study since 1938. So it's ongoing and it's intense. They survey the same people and they're surveying now the descendants of those people, so their whole families. And they actually go out to their houses and interview them every so years. It's really an intense, comprehensive study. And the conclusion when they first were able to make one is identical to what it is in 2023, which is that our happiness, our human thriving is all predicated not just on human connection, but frequent human connection. So CEOs are going to lean into this and they're going to say, see, we've told you. But I believe that it can be accomplished through hybrid. I really do think it could be accomplished through hybrid. I'm not a fan of telling people you can work remotely for the rest of your life. I don't think that does society well. I don't think it does human beings well. And there's science now that kind of really proves it.
That's a great share. And I people will ask me very, very often, like, what are your thoughts about working from home and working from the office? And I said, well, I think they can coexist. And our hardwired condition is to build deep connection and a sense of belonging. And I really do wonder whether we can do that when we're virtual. We can give it a good shot, but there's nothing like me and you talking like this from a long way away. If we bumped into each other physically, I think that would increase and improve the level of connectivity and the sense of belonging to a tribe. And I just caution people who get too carried away with the one or the other. Because I think, like you said, with the head and the heart, it's the same with this. There's got to be a balance. And there's just so much of this. We can all work from home or we all need to be back in the office. Well, I think we've got to get a bit more mature and start to accept that we can do it both ways.
You know, I think it was close to 2 years ago, maybe like, I don't know, 18, 19, 20 months ago when we first went back to the office after COVID. And I wrote an article, and in the article I said, because I'm the heart guy and we don't connect here, we connect here. So I was already fully aware of the science, which demonstrates that we need human beings around us in order to thrive, long before I saw the study from Harvard. And so I basically laid it out and said, it's really not in anybody's best interest to go back to the office, to stay away from the office full time. Like, we're going to have time to connect. And I never got hate mail before from letters that from articles that I wrote, but I did this time. And basically, there are people calling me a corporate shill and saying, you know, you're being paid by the CEOs to say this. And so now I kind of feel like I'm being vindicated because all of the science is coming out, but something else is happening. People are realizing it for themselves. It's like you're 17 years old and you start smoking for the first time. And then you wake up one day and you're 35 years old. You go to the doctor and the doctor goes, hey, man, you got a serious lung problem.
Yep.
And you're like, are you saying it's a result of the smoking? And it's like, well, we're just having so much fun when we're young and we're working from home and we don't have to go to the office and I can wear my crappy clothes. And but all of a sudden it catches up with you. And yep. I think we're starting to see a little of that where people are like, I'm lonely. I miss people. I don't want to be here by myself all day long. I don't want to do every meeting by Zoom. I think there's a lot of people like that, which is why they're, you know, the threat 2 years ago was, you bring me back to the office and I'm quitting. Well, we haven't really seen any evidence of that.
No.
People may not be happy about it, but I think if they're going back on a hybrid schedule where they're in the office 2 or 3 days a week, they kind of go, hey, it's a better deal than I had, you know, 3 years ago.
And quiet quitting got such a big run on, you know, everyone's quitting and like everyone's leaving. And it's like, well, when you get underneath it and under the data, the amount of quitting might have had a little bit of a spike at a certain time, but it wasn't too different to historically what we've seen. I wanted to ask you, because I reckon what you described before, Mark, was real leadership. When you started to get that hate mail, someone who leads from the heart and is very human, how did that initially feel for you? And then how did you work your way through knowing that this is unpopular, but you know what? That's what leadership is at times. What was it like for you?
Well, it's a really great question. And, you know, ordinarily I put a lot of time and energy into this. I don't want people hating me because of this. And it wasn't as if, you know, I woke up and there were bags and bags of mail at my house and people out to get me. It wasn't that. It's just, there were a lot of negative responses to the article, and it was all from people who thought that the idea of working from home had been proven effective and we should never take it away. That's where people were. I would say that because, you know, when you think back to the beginning of this conversation and I told you this journey that I've been on, I've taken a lot of punches for all these years. And so I think just like, I mean, every day I have to get up and go, is this worth it? You know, am I making a difference? Because there's a lot of other alternatives. Life is short. And I think what I'm really predicating my daily work on is I'm absolutely certain in my message. I'm absolutely certain in what I'm talking about. And so I just need to find different ways of getting, and part of it is just a consciousness change. People have to be willing to say, maybe what we're doing isn't working so well, so maybe we should look at other alternatives, and then that opens up the gates for people to go, well, I'll try that. That's not where we're at, but that's where I'm trying to get people at.
Yeah.
But I think with this article, I've been roughed up enough times that it was the same conclusion. It was like, no, I know I'm right about this, and it's just going to be a matter of time before people figure it out. And so kind of feeling good about that because I was right 2 years ago.
There's a great leadership lesson in that for anyone listening, and I use these three words very deliberately: hold your nerve. And that's what has to happen in this work, because both of us, I guess it would have been called lots of names about this stuff. And there are times where you do think to yourself, bloody hell, like, wouldn't it be easier just to jump back on the other bus and have a very, very smooth ride? But I think there's too much at stake. And again, recently you quoted someone, I think from Microsoft, and I didn't write that down, but I should have, someone who was talking about, we are in the middle of a human energy crisis. I think we feel that in Australia as well, but there's something globally going on here. And is it a result of the pandemic totally, or was it already going on before the pandemic hit?
I think it was. So first of all, it was the person that you're quoting is the head of HR, the chief human resources officer for Microsoft.
Yep.
And she made the assertion, which is kind of interesting because Microsoft has historically had kind of a really, particularly in the Nadella years, has had a great reputation for how they care about people. So how she would have optics into a global problem like that, I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I knew she was right. And to answer your question, the second question you asked, which is this something that's post-COVID or pre-COVID? It's definitely pre-COVID. I think it goes back, to be honest with you, it goes back to the day that we got our iPhones.
Yep.
I walk the beach every morning at 5 o'clock in the dark. And it's like a meditation, and it's like the most wonderful part of my day. And now, right now in this window, generally at 5 o'clock in the morning, it's dark and I'm the only one on the beach and I'm just so grateful. But now there's people on the beach walking or running or whatever. They're on the beach at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I cannot tell you how many of them have their head down looking at this when the ocean is right next to them. Like, they're oblivious to why they even went. So I'm trying to punctuate the point that they've become so addictive that even though we say to ourselves, you know, we have no boundaries, I go home and I'm getting texts from my boss, or my boss is asking me to jump on a call or respond to an email and give them an answer, we're doing it to ourselves because the technology is so addictive. And we also feel like, I don't want to get in trouble if I don't respond. So all of this is working against us. So I think we're burnt out, is that we just don't get enough fun. We don't get enough family time. We're just time to veg, which is what that morning walk is for me. If I don't get that, I'm wonked. There's something wrong with my day. And most people don't get it. We get up and you're working from home. I read it's like 16 steps to your desk. You know, you're not going anywhere. You're just walking from the bed to the desk. We're just absorbed with this. And I think we have to unwind it. And I think since this is a leadership podcast, leaders need to be the ones to start to prescribe and say, look, I may send out a message at 7 o'clock at night. I absolutely do not expect you to respond to anything from 7 to 7. I don't want to hear from you. I don't expect it. I'm going to be upset if you do. Put your phone away. Be with your family. Get a hobby. Go play golf. Go swim. Go sleep. Do whatever you need to do. Come back tomorrow recharged. We don't have the courage to do it. And you know why? You know why? Because managers go, I like it that he's still working. And so you're facilitating my success. And it's a selfishness. And I think, you know, the irony is that, and Gallup has sort of concluded this, that when people feel like they're doing it on their own initiative, there's not as much stress.
Yeah.
The stress is there when you send me the email and now I'm looking at it going, do I have to respond to this? Well, if I don't, I'm going to get in trouble and everybody else is, and I'm going to be on and on and on it goes. And so we have to respond to it. But if a manager says, hey, I don't expect this, I want to establish some boundaries here so you can have some freedom to live. The people who decide I'm still going to work after 7 or 5 or 6, whatever, they're doing it on their own initiative and that feels good to them. So they don't have that stress. This is the paradox. If you just gave people boundaries, you could unburden people in ways that I think we don't even imagine because we've had these now for 20 years.
Yeah. I love the work of the founders of adaptive leadership, Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky. And Marty often talks about, people have heard me quote this, humans fear loss much more than they value gain. So that loss of reputation, that loss of identity, that loss of seen to be loyal absolutely outweighs the gain of connection with family, community, self. And I think that's one of the great leadership opportunities now is for the people who are in charge to start to behave in a way that their people will mirror. And I reckon that's the great opportunity right now.
Totally agree. And it has to happen that way, right? Because we do. When I was in college, I worked at a men's clothing store. And we had a regional manager, and I was working for a manager, I'll just call him Jim. And Jim was the manager of the store where I was working. And in the time that I was working for Jim, we had 3 different regional managers who would come in occasionally. But what happened instantaneously was Jim became the regional manager he was working for at the time. So he's behaving in one way, and then the new guy comes in, he sheds that, and takes off. It was like a complete mimic.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, amusing that he was so influenced that way, kind of over the top. But it reminded me at a very early age that whoever we're around is influencing us. And if we have a manager that we're spending all day long with, we're going to start to adopt their practices, their behaviors, their attitudes and beliefs. So it really does start with the individual manager, and then the expectation is that it will ripple.
Yeah.
That people will learn and grow underneath that kind of leadership. You're absolutely right.
And for managers who have said to me at times, and they get a pretty straight response when they go, I'm really encouraging my people to get better work-life balance, which is what I call it life design, because I think work-life balance makes an assumption that there's work and then there's life. And I actually think work's an important part of your life. So I'll say to them, it doesn't work that way. Like, you can tell them until the cows come home about getting work-life balance and don't do this and don't do that. But whatever they see you do, it's like when a manager leaves the office early and everyone clamors out straight after it. It's an early minute. So they all leave, and then, or if they leave late, they all hang around till the boss leaves and then they all sort of leave then. It's, there's so much opportunity there, I think. And I guess I wanted to dig a bit now into the research that you've been looking at since 2011, is there anything new that's come out since what we've experienced in the last 4 years? I know you've put out a second edition of your book as well, haven't you? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Is there anything new in there that you're sharing in there that are research-based?
Yeah. So I'll start with the cover, because I hope you can see it.
Yes.
It's in the blue in the back. So when I originally did it, the original cover emphasized more of a sacred heart, like a spiritual heart, because it's inherently a spiritual message. We are spiritual beings, whether we acknowledge it or not. And it was muted, so it wasn't, you know, really out there. But what it really wasn't was this. It wasn't the romantic Valentine heart. And that was what people conflated with the whole idea. So the new cover, you can see in the middle, is an anatomical heart.
Yep.
So what I'm trying to convey to people is that, A, it's not the romantic Valentine heart that you fantasize, and that implies that there's science because it's the physical anatomical heart. But what happened was, in the midst of COVID, my publisher came to me and said, you know, your book actually sold more copies last year than all years before. And I said, why? And they said, well, because we think they're finally accepting it. Like, it's happening now. So would you be willing to write a second edition in 100 days or less? And it took me 2 years to do it the first time. I'm like, 100 days? So it was very stressful, but it just flowed out of me. But I was the beneficiary. I have my own podcast, and the intention of the podcast has always been to bring on people who have cutting-edge research that validates the original premise in some meaningful way. And so what happened in those 11, 12 years was a couple of things. One was I got very close to Gallup, and they confirmed that things have only gotten worse since 2011, not better. Like, negative emotions around the world, anger and hostility. And I mean, we see it every day, but it's amplified because people are unhappy in their lives, and then people aren't happy at work. So I was able to get in the new book state-of-the-art data that showed we got a problem. You can't argue with the problem. And it's not just work anymore. It's people in their broader lives. But I had more than one person, a Yale professor, two Yale professors, and a guy who was at Caltech, which is arguably, you know, the most intelligent people on the planet. And these are people that are building rocket ships and breakthrough science. And the three of them wrote books about human emotions. And the conclusion that they came to was that Descartes famously said, I think, therefore I am.
Yep.
And basically what he's telling us is we're rational beings. Everything that we do is rational. And if you're really smart, you will push your emotions aside and diminish them because they're irrelevant. They're only going to get you into trouble. Make your decisions up here. And the research that I was able to glean from these conversations and from their books was that up to 95% of our behavior is driven by feelings and emotions. So if that's the case, then we should be doing things that give people the experience of positive emotions. I call it emotional currency.
Yep.
Instead of paying people with money, which is an intellectual experience, reward people with things that are going to give them an emotional experience that makes them feel good, which then translates into the positive behaviors that we're looking for. So once again, long story to get to the punctuation, which is all I was able to do. And I wrote three additional chapters and an afterword, all new information, massive, massive validation of the original premise. So there wasn't, oh, you know, in 2011, I said this and this was wrong. In 2022, I was able to say everything that you read was correct. And here's more profound confirmation. And I didn't know that was going to happen, obviously, but that is what happened. So the new book is just filled, and it also adds an element of like the impacts. There's such amazing science now on things that we've always thought were weakness. Like, you can think about this in your own experience. Kindness, you know, what a jerk to be kind to people. That's only going to backfire. And then empathy and compassion. The science around this is overwhelmingly positive. So at the very beginning of a conversation, you were talking about, and your podcast is Simply Practical Human. And so in my evolution, I have really leaned into the word humane more than I'm using human any longer.
Yep.
For the purpose of saying that it's the humane behaviors that actually translate into what people truly need in exchange for work. When we are humane, because humans can be, I'm just going to say it, we can be dicks. We can be the most horrible people to other people. And we see it all day long. And I don't understand it with all that's been out there that shows leaders that that is not the way to go. But when we are humane, when we actually think about people and about how our decisions are going to make them feel and impact them, it changes the decisions we make, or it changes how we communicate them. And by being that thoughtful and by that caring, people can feel that, hey, you made a tough decision here. I don't necessarily like it, but I sure liked the way he handled it, or she handled it, the way she communicated it, and the way she thought of me, and the way she asked for feedback. All of that comes from here. It doesn't come from here. And so I was grateful because it was like manna from heaven.
Yeah.
Some of the information that I was able to add literally came out the month that I was finishing the book. So I was able to insert it, and then the book came out, and all of this research had just been completed, and here it is in the book.
First of all, congratulations for doing that in 100 days, because like you said, you know, 2 years for the other one and then 100 days to get this together. I just love that the persistence, that the willingness to tolerate the this isn't right and this is all kumbaya type stuff. I remember the getting asked by some senior managers about why the results were so good. And I said, we focus on thankfulness, helpfulness, care, and fun. What about the KPIs? Well, they take care of themselves after we focus on the other stuff. I love how you put the E on the end of human as well. I think that's a fantastic thing. 3 or 4 years ago when we spoke in the original podcast, you gave the listeners some really simple and practical things to think about, either reinforce what they're doing or giving them some new tools and tips. Is there anything 3 or 4 years down the track, just simple and practical things that they can do that can help them to accept and also practice this leading from the heart?
You know, I saw this article today, coincidentally, and what it said was that there are companies, not just individual managers, but companies that are looking at people who are working remotely who don't want to come back into the office. And they're saying, okay, you don't want to come in the office? Well, then we're going to pay you less. And we're going to treat you like a gig worker. And you're not going to get benefits. And we're not going to develop you and train you. And I just look at that and I just go, oh God, it's going to be another 12 years before I'm ever successful because this is what I'm up against. This kind of we, they, us against them, you know, we need to punish these people, that this kind of a mentality. So the distinguishing feedback that I would give this time would be give your people a voice. Like, you can't make decisions that will please everybody all the time. And in fact, this whole COVID thing, you got people that never wanted to work from home. They don't have the right space. They want to have a separate place to go to. My former assistant, who is a major, major introvert, I go, when this was first happening, 2020, I go, you have to be loving this. And she goes, I hate it. Because this is, being with people is the only time I get it is when I'm at work and I don't want to be alone. I'm alone all the rest of the time. And it was this huge insight for me. Yeah. Everybody is different. So you're going to make decisions that are going to make people upset. You're going to make decisions that are going to make people really happy. But as long as you're giving them voice, you're just saying, tell me what you think. Tell me what you feel. I hope you understand that I can't please everyone, but I do want to know what you're thinking. I want to know, is there some ground that I can touch where I can make a decision that isn't 100% against what you want? You know, if I can get it down to 90 or 85, it's still not the answer, but it's better. So how can I do that? Share some ideas. People want to be heard. This is the point. They want to be heard. They don't want to be negated. And they think that CEOs have a mindset that they're coming up with in their own offices without talking to anybody and without really intending to listen. They've already fixed their mindset. It's like, this isn't going to work. I'm not going to do it. We need to get people back. We're going to wait until the economy turns and people need jobs so that they can't quit. And then we're going to pull the rug out from under them. And I'm like, that is the mistake managers make, is that we're going to find some way to get back at these people. They didn't create COVID. They didn't create these circumstances. Put yourself in their position and have a little concern for what they're thinking and feeling. And then make some decisions, do some experiments, try different things. Don't just say no. It's this flexibility. And, you know, somebody's going to say to you or to me, you know, all of this takes time and I don't have time. You know, I just need to make the decision and tell people to come back. And I'm like, okay, but where do you get the rewards? It's like people coming up to you and going, where are you on the KPIs? And you're going, no, that's not our agenda. We'll get there, but we're going to get there in a different way. Some people just don't want to hear it. And they think, I don't have time to spend on this. But I'm saying, if you do spend the time, you're going to build relationships with people that are powerful. And when people have powerful relationships with their boss, they stay, they commit, they contribute, they do wonderful things, they support you when you need them. So put your time into people and give them a voice.
I think time's a really interesting concept. With the more time we spend with the people and hearing them and listening and giving them the voice, so too the research shows is the more connected we become, the more we build our social capital. But I think the old way has always been, Mark, it's like, I'll do that other stuff, I'll do that humane stuff or that human stuff once I've done the real work. And the opportunity I see for leaders to start to think about is there are two types of work, and they're both really important, but don't leave one as the, I'll do that when I get the chance, because guess what? They never find the chance to do that work because they get so caught up in the weekly results, the quarterly review, the half-year performance review, or the, you know, the full-year financials. And it's one of the biggest mistakes that I call them the busy fools. They fool themselves that they're busy because they want to avoid doing the humane work, because the humane work's really bloody hard, isn't it?
It's exhausting. It can be. I mean, I remember, you know, coming home on Friday nights and we'd have dinner and I would pass out.
Yep.
So I'm exhausted at the end of the week. But as I look back on my career and I see the relationships that I established and the impact that they had on people's lives, that's much more satisfying to me, as you get longer in the tooth, to know that you actually made a difference in people's lives. And it wasn't just about making money or hitting goals or pleasing a boss. So there's that element of this, you know, and I think we lose sight of that. And I'm hoping that in the context of COVID, that the consciousness of managers is opening up, that they're seeing that people are having a hard time, that they saw that, that they needed to slow down. But, you know, the other point that I would make that you just made that I would add on to this is that when you coach someone, you're dedicating time to them. And you're teaching them something that you know. And that adds up to, I matter to you, I'm valued, I'm important. And so it also fits into the, how come I don't have time for coaching? Well, because we're so focused on our goals and next year's strategy and all the stuff that we tell ourselves, our mind tells us we need to do, when sitting down with people and actually elevating their talent and expertise is the most extraordinary and accelerated way of getting better performance out of people, because you're spending time with them and you're sharing what you've already learned and mastered, as long as you're a generous person.
Yeah.
It's such a huge thing. And so now the sad thing to me, I don't know if you've been seeing this, but companies like BetterUp are AIing it.
Oh. I've seen it.
People are going to have AI chatbot coaches instead of their manager doing the coaching. And I just want to cry. I mean, I think they can program it to be helpful, but there's nothing like, I mean, I think about critical parts of my life, I'm sure you do, where you were at a crossroads and you needed to make an important decision, like big time decision. Do I marry this person? Do I take this job? Do I move? Is this the major I'm going to have in college? All those kinds of decisions. And you don't make them in a vacuum. You make them with another human being or other human beings who've been there before, or you trust, who are going to give you that information. I don't want to sit with a chatbot and go, should I marry this person? You know, have you considered this? Have you, you know, it's such a human experience and we're going to a chatbot. Like, I have a difficult employee. And I need to know what to do. Have you considered doing this? I'm like, no, man, talk to some human being about this. But the void is being filled by AI because we're not willing to do it ourselves.
I do two podcasts a week now, Mark, and one of them comes out Friday. And I call it the 4S podcast: short, sharp, solo, self-indulgent. Goes for about 12 minutes. Today's one was about the one-to-ones and the coaching. And basically my message was this. If you keep canceling those things, this is as simple as it gets. Your people feel that you don't feel they're important. You can, and you can polish it up any way you want with your message about, I couldn't do it, I didn't have time, and there are other things, and the work's important. But when it comes down to the basic human message you're giving someone is, you are not important enough for me to invest some of my time into your growth, development, and these things. So I love that you shared that. The podcast, your podcast, because your podcast is right up there. Like, it's how many countries now? How many countries are tuning in?
174.
Oh, we see. I'd written down a number and I went, I don't think this number's current now. I think at one stage it was 127. So 174, and you're up in the top, is it top 1.5% of leadership podcasts? So tell us a bit about the podcast, because I'm sure people who listen to this one will go, I need to listen to that one as well. Give us the name and where people can get hold of it.
So it's called the Lead from the Heart podcast. So clever, right? Right after the book. And we talked about this a little bit ago, but when the book came out and I started to realize I've got opposition, and it's not real opposition, it's just people that dismiss the idea of leading with heart so quickly that they aren't open to learning about it and to understanding why. It's like, that's dead on arrival. So I started to write for Fast Company magazine, and I did that, wrote like, I don't know, 20 articles before I realized, you know, it might be helpful because people could read it and go, well, he's not quite the nut that I thought he was. He's actually making sense. But then I thought, well, if I did a podcast, then people could actually hear me. But I'm intentional about, like you are, by the way, I want to compliment you. You're very focused on your guest. But I think what happens is that people, by virtue of a couple of things, I intensely prepare for them. So nobody comes on without me reading their book. And after I read their book, I usually type up like 10 pages of notes, and then I go back and create the questions and generally get people to go, how did you know to ask me that question? Like they're kind of like weirded out, you know, like you know my work kind of a thing. But that allows me to avoid questions like, so tell us, why did you write the book? And, you know, what are the three best things that we can take from it? Like, I don't ever want to ask a question like that, right? So I can get really into them. And, you know, I had Tom Peters on as my second guest. Mm. And I had older brothers, and one of them went to Vietnam. So I'm reading about Tom Peters, and I just happened to see that he was a captain in Vietnam. And so my first question to him was, do you think that your experience in Vietnam had a fundamental influence in like altering your view of leadership? Like, did it send you in a different trajectory after you had that experience? And I'm asking it because I'm sort of curious about my brother's experience. He never really shut. Tom Peters almost started crying. Like, you could, he goes, no one has ever asked me that, man. No one has ever, like, that's how he was so emotional about it. It was like, then he went, yes, like, and so it was in that moment that I realized, okay, like, I'm being guided here, you know? And so the success of it blows my mind, but it's also, look, it's not This American Life or Adam Grant or Brené Brown. I mean, these people are in a league of their own, so I don't mean to represent it as, you know, this is the biggest podcast in the world. But it's doing very, very well. And I think a lot of it has to do with the preparation. But I also think, Mark, that it's finally people are curious.
Yep.
They can go for a run and listen to some guy talk about leading from the heart, and there's nobody around them laughing at what they're listening to. Mm. It's not that bad, but I think it plays into that. The people are listening, and then they see the kinds of celebrities that I have on. When I mean celebrities, they're Harvard Business School professors, Wharton, Yale, MIT, Caltech. You can't argue with the kind of caliber of people. And so when people hear it, they go, well, maybe this guy's right after all by virtue of who he has on. So it's working in that respect. And so I appreciate your asking.
No, I love it. I'm just going to put something else out there too. The old law of unintended consequences. I really don't know why I started doing a podcast. I just thought I'd like talking to human beings. It is the greatest learning laboratory that I have ever been subjected to. And how does it feel for you? Because how blessed are we that we get to learn from, like, I'm getting to learn from you. Yesterday I was talking to a lady in Portugal about certainty is death, she calls it, because she goes, we need to embrace uncertainty. And I come off going, that was my classroom lesson this week. How does that sit with you?
The same. Exactly. Like I'm not kidding. So where I am right now, looking at you, is where I record the podcast. But you're not there. I'm alone. And, you know, we turn the cameras off for bandwidth, so I'm just listening to people. And I can't tell you how many times a part of me exits my body and goes, do you believe you're having this conversation right now? Like, you know, is this great or what? Like, I had Bill George,
yep,
who was the former CEO of Medtronic and is a big believer in leading from the heart. It's language that he actually uses. But he's a hard ass. He's a real hard ass. But he's also a business school professor. He's been teaching at Harvard for 20 years. So he's got the legitimate chops of being a CEO, and he's got the legitimate chops of teaching at one of the greatest business schools in the country, right, or the world. And he's using this expression, lead from the heart. But he came on, and he was so prepared, like he was on fire. And so it was like, choo, 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 choo. It was like this, you know, just great conversation. And I swear to God, I'm like out in the yard going, is this really happening? Like, this is so great. But when I mentioned this to you before, when I was writing the book, I was like, holy cow. Like, I just have to go through the catalog. I had Amy Epinson on,
yep,
and I had her on before anybody had her on. And we were talking about psychological safety before her book came out. And she was telling me about the book. So I held up the podcast so that I could actually read the book, and it was everything that we had talked about. But this is somebody who basically laid out a piece of leadership that no one had thought about 10 years ago. Like, we never really thought about the importance of that. So I went back and listened to the podcast and transcribed the things that were important and then put that into the book. And coincidentally, this is a funny story. I believe that it's feelings and emotions. So it's not here, it's here. So all the science, all this stuff that I've gotten and gleaned from this podcast is that it's feelings and emotions that drive human behavior. So as I'm listening to Amy, so by the way, I have asked her at this point in time if she would write a testimonial for my book, and she's agreed.
Wow.
But in the process of writing what she's about to read, and I'm writing about psychological safety, I don't ask me why. I completely forgot that I had asked her to do this and that she was going to read it. And I said, I would actually recommend that we not call it psychological safety, that we call it psychological and emotional safety, because it's feelings that we're really talking about. And so if anything, it should be emotional safety, but minimally it should be psychological and emotional. But that's just my opinion, because it's already formed and defined by Harvard Business School, Amy Epinson. She read the book, gave me the testimonial, and never said a word to me about it.
Amazing.
So I think she must have agreed is the point.
Yeah, great share. Just to wrap it up, I you're talking about feelings and things like that. I always get this sense as we wrap up that when I get off the podcast, it's like everything that's happened today as we're talking, there's been, and I'm pointing to my head now, people, there's been nothing really happening up here. I got to ask questions, but everything that's going on is below the neck. It's like there's goosebumps at times, and there's like you can just feel it. When you were talking before about something, I'm like, that's straight into the feeling space. That is some of the magic that you bring, mate. And I just want to say thank you for coming back onto the podcast. You are a damn fine human being. And I do hope we catch up a little bit more regularly than maybe once every 3 years. So, Mark, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, I take some blame for that too, my friend. But thank you. This is a fantastic conversation. And you not only ask great questions, but I'll return the favor. You're a wonderful human being. And if feelings and emotions drive behavior, if you can make me feel safe, if you can make me feel like, hey, Mark, you have something to say and I want you to say it so that I can share it, that creates a feeling inside. And that's when I think the magic happens as a hot podcast guest.
Yep.
When people can go, wow, like, yeah, I'll tell you about that. You know, no one's ever asked me that question before, because you've given them the freedom to be themselves. And what I find is the worst podcasts are the ones where, and they haven't happened very often, but they've happened, where there's zero connection. I can't feel anything from this person. They're either guarded or they're on the clock or they think they're owed, like, you know, I deserve to be on your podcast because I'm an author or whatever. And it, whatever happens is the chemistry isn't there and it's just not good. It just, I literally had to trash a podcast that was so bad that I just never published it. And the person never came back and asked me, which was fine. But, you know, it doesn't happen very often. But if you can create the feeling inside where people want to share, that's a gift. And you have that.
I appreciate that. Sometimes people say that to me. They're like, we don't know why in 10 minutes, not just in the podcast, but in the training room. They're like, I don't know how in 10 minutes you can get me to open up and say things that I'd never want to say. And I go, I don't know how I do it either, but look, let's just keep doing it. Mate, we share more than the same Christian name. I think we share a passion for leading from the heart and this humane stuff. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. What a joy.
One of the things that is helpful for me to know that the podcast is hitting the money is how I feel during the podcast and at the end of the podcast. And we talked about that, Mark and I, at the end. It's just that feeling of, it's not about what I was thinking about, it was how I was feeling and the goosebumps that I was getting and just the responses I was feeling between, let's say, the neck and the navel when Mark was speaking about certain things along the way. Just his persistence at staying strong and holding his nerve with the message because it's the right thing to do. And at times being subjected to a little bit of, as he said, hate mail, not bags and bags of it, but just enough to sort of say to him that, why are you doing this stuff? And then he asked himself that question, well, why am I? Why am I such a supporter of leading from the heart? And I think it would have come out in spades today. Some of the things that he shared, which back up what we talked about 3 or 4 years ago, the message and his message is still on point. And now he's got some research because he's written that second edition of Lead from the Heart. And it's absolutely showing up in the research why it's important for human beings, for leaders, for managers, for whatever we want to situation we see ourselves in, to embrace and combine leading from the heart with leading from the head and getting out of this idea that it all happens from the head. And, you know, we had some good chats today about the impacts of COVID. I like the points he made about the fact that it needs to be hybrid. You know, it's not about all from home and all from the office, but you know, there is fear that is driving people to make some pretty irrational decisions right now, or even some legacy of how things were in the past and that we need to go back there. And I think he really debunked the myths that it's not all about just being human or humane, but it's combining that and using that as a starting point to combine with that technical, that more cognitive work that we do. His ideas of giving people a voice, experimenting, being flexible, that it takes time with this work. And sometimes people don't think we've got time, but you've got to put time into it. Role modeling and demonstrating the behaviors that you want to see from the people that you are privileged enough to be managing or leading. It's another great point. And just his little anecdotal stories along the way, the research he does, the conversations he has, the learning and the generosity that he is bringing by sharing his knowledge, but the wisdom of others that he's talking to, I think you pick up a lot. Make sure you check his podcast out, the Leading from the Heart podcast. It's a ripper podcast, and you'll hear from some amazing guests on there. And as Mark said towards the end, the way that he asks questions and the research that he does is not all about the usual vanilla questions, but getting below that and getting into who the human is. Hey, if you love this one as much as I did recording it, and I really did, I think I'm going to have an amazing energy-filled day today. Give us a 5-star rating. Tell us why, if you liked it. Share it with your friends. Maybe share it with your enemies as well. It's up to you. You might just have that moment where you think you can help them out as well, or your frenemies, as I like to call them. But until next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, keep it human, but also, as Mark says, let's keep it humane. Bye for now.